the notion of the creative piece was so important to this, ultimately to what Saybrook is about and what the humanistic tradition is all about.
Hey everyone, Nathan here, president of Saybrook University. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. My first years at Saybrook, I was thrilled to be part of an institution with such a rich and amazing legacy. Our founders and contributors to its founding included luminaries like Abraham Maslow, the pyramid guy, right? The hierarchy of needs. We have folks like Carl Rogers and many others who really made a difference and contributed to who we are today. What surprised me, though, was that our institution's history was often hard to nail down and get consistency. As with many institutions, there's often a great deal of myth how one thing was done or founded, who and what were happening at a certain point in time. Lore that often, while well-intentioned, frequently misses the important players who are central to the work being done. And I'm thinking of individuals like our very first leader, Dr. Eleanor Criswell, who, while recognized by some, was not always in the larger narrative. She wasn't alone, and we're certainly proud now that we've brought her back into the fold, so to speak. Supervising dissertations and guest lecturing, she is fabulous, and our conversations always leave me excited and hopeful for our future, knowing exactly what Eleanor brought to us at the very beginning and how that's really carried through over these 50 plus years. And that brings me now to my guest, Dr. Lauren Buckman, recently retired president of Art Center College of Design right here in Pasadena, California. During his tenure at Art Center, Lauren left a tremendous legacy, one that I could only hope to leave for an institution. The increasing enrollment, expanding the endowment to eye-popping levels, and developing the Art Center brand in ways that have furthered its international reputation. It's really quite impressive. And Lauren, of course, rightfully, and just because of the person he is, makes sure to credit all the people that he works with and alongside. But he's an important part of that story. And Lauren has another part of his own professional biography, and that's as former president of Saybrook University. I learned about his work early on from others, similarly to how I learned about Eleanor in bits and pieces, fits and starts, that first passing mention, and then a chance encounter followed by several in-person meetings. In our first of many get-togethers, I was immediately drawn to his charm, his intellect, his way of telling a story, his authenticity, and his passion for higher education and for Saybrook. Most notably, Lauren was responsible for our move from a graduate institute to a more comprehensive university, and I think you're going to really enjoy hearing how that manifested itself in his work with our faculty and staff. So naturally, in today's interview, I'm going to focus on Saybrook University, Lauren's time here, and much more, especially where creativity is concerned. Having his narrative on how we became the university we are today, where we're going, and how the students can find the most value is going to be a treat. So let's have at it with President Lauren Buckman. Dr. Lauren Buckman, this is the highlight of my day to have you on Saybrook Insights. It's really great to have you here, sir. Before we get started, tell the audience about yourself. You'll need no introduction with many of our faculty, but for those out there that don't know you, just getting a sense of your personal journey as well as how you ended up at Saybrook University would be fabulous.
My personal journey, well, let's say that grew up in Canada, in Toronto, discovered that I loved the theater, tried my hand at acting, and found out that I was actually a really bad actor. More on that to come. But interestingly, I discovered that what I did love to do, what was almost a calling for me in an interesting way, was directing for the theater. Stumbled into it by really pure accident, but found great joy, great fulfillment, a sense of real personal thriving directing a play, which then had huge ramifications for my sense of leadership going forward. Found my way then to a program at Stanford University, the PhD program there, which interestingly, and is really what drew me, had to do with not only the scholarship that surrounds the theater, its history, its literature, its theory, but also it was a directing training program as well. And the idea was that you would be in both the rehearsal hall and the seminar room, and that those two endeavors were mutually nourishing. So you can already anticipate how significant that is for my time in art education, but also for my time at Saybrook, and what it meant at Saybrook to have a practicing faculty who were both engaged in the practice and in the study and the scholarship, and how those two endeavors really became important to the fabric of the place and the kinds of students that we were drawing. I was on the faculty at University of California, Berkeley, in the theater department, teaching exactly what I just described. I was teaching dramatic literature and theory, and I was also teaching practical courses in directing plays. And really, I got tenure there and thought my life would be there forever until the art and design school down the street, California College of the Arts, it was called California College of Arts and Crafts at the time, recruited me to be a provost. And it was a tricky time at Berkeley, a lot of cuts, a lot of difficulty being in the arts there. And so I was quite drawn. And, you know, as I had tenure, I was able really to kind of take a leave from Berkeley and explore what this college was about. This college that was, you know, really had this mission of educating creative people, which was something I couldn't resist. It wasn't about the theater. It was about what it meant to create creative education, which is exactly what I was, or education of creative people, which is exactly what I was doing when I was at Berkeley. I fell in love with CCA quite quickly. And again, if it's pertinent, this can come up later, but I was the provost there. I was the, you know, academic vice president. And shortly after I arrived, the president who hired me left and went to another institution, and the board appointed me as the interim president. So I had suddenly this challenge in front of me, and thank goodness I had training as a theater director, because that really did well by me. And, you know, moved on and ultimately was appointed the permanent president of CCA. And so began my career as a college president. It was a really wonderful time. But I think the most important point to stress right now is I stumbled into it. I didn't grow up, you know, you'd think I would have grown up, I'm going to be a dentist or a firefighter or something like that. But I didn't think about I would grow up and be a college president. But there I was, and there you are.
Yeah, you were like Gordon Gee at, do you remember, you know who he is, right?
Where yeah, exactly right.
He always wanted to be a college president, and I thought, that is so strange. I could never imagine having wanted that like 30 years ago. Yeah.
Anyhow, had a wonderful time at California College of the Arts, and then was doing some other projects with nonprofits, and I believe it was Ralph Wolf at WASC who knew some of the work that I was doing, and Saybrook had fallen on some challenging times and thought maybe it would be a good idea for me to go and help them actually merge with another institution at the time. That was the plan. But I arrived at Saybrook, found this really interesting board led by this incredible woman whose name is Alison Shapiro. And as I say, this fantastic faculty who, again, maybe a little upset and cranky, but brilliant and dedicated and loving and wanting to make something. And there was a very special quality to the place. And it seemed it would have been, the loss would have been so profound for it to simply merge into another institution. And so we spent our time really trying to figure out how we could stay alive independently, autonomously at that time. And really began to ask the question about Saybrook's enrollment, what the world was clamoring for that Saybrook could offer, how we could take the principles and values of humanistic psychology and understand how they might be pertinent to a 21st century student, and how those values may have migrated to other areas of study and thinking. And those conversations were alive and were rich, and from it was born the concept of the university, that there would be multiple colleges, disciplines, integrated on the level of values and principles, and yet diversified by the kinds of questions maybe that were being asked or the particular field of endeavor that was being studied. And it was beautiful. It was just beautiful to see it emerge the way it did. And now, of course, under your great leadership, it's matured and it's blossomed and it's taken on all these fabulous directions. And I would say it did eventually merge with a larger community. But the key was that Saybrook at that moment, even though it was, you know, financially wobbly and had some issues, but it came from a position of strength. The idea of the university had been established. It had a kind of sense of identity and sense of where it was heading, and on that level came from a place of strength. Whereas when I first arrived, that merger probably would have come from a place of greater weakness, only because the faculty, the staff, the trustees, they hadn't had a time to really talk through what a future course might be.
Well, and I think first of all, I appreciate the kind words, but it's my successor at my previous institution says we all stand on the shoulders of others, you know, in lifting up the institution as we can and try. You know, one of the advantages I think we had with the engagement with TCS education system was, you know, it wasn't your typical merger or alignment or partnership in the sense that, to your point, Saybrook didn't lose its identity, right? It didn't get wrapped under as a college within a larger institution. It's been able to retain its autonomous status as a university, a separate nonprofit within this bigger system. And I think you're absolutely right. Without that, I don't know, maybe proving ground under your leadership where you all had to explore those ins and outs of where Saybrook was going, where it could go, how we could manifest a different future. You know, we certainly would not have been able to be successful in 2014. So I appreciate that acknowledgement and your understanding of that history too. Let me back up here. When I first got there, I had a paper sitting on my desk from Ann Luckish, who was our previous chief of staff. I think you might remember Ann.
Remember her well, of course.
She said, "I think you want to read this before you do anything else." And I sat down, and it was probably about 15 pages, maybe a little less, a little more. And it was a white paper that you had written. I'm like, who is this Lauren Buckman guy? On a humanistic vision for a new institution or for a reimagined institution at Saybrook University. And there was a lot of great stuff in there. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because one of the objectives with having you on today is to really talk about the legacy of the university, because you brought us from an institute essentially to a university model. And that white paper, I think, really guided us. And I know there was a lot that went into that. So maybe if you could talk to us a bit about that, it'd be great.
You know, one day you should send me a copy of that. I hope my spelling was okay. I'd love to see it. I can tell you though, Nathan, that really my memory really goes back to what I was just saying, that we were asking maybe a different kind of question about taking the deep and very meaningful values and principles of humanistic psychology, really, where it was located so strongly, and understanding how it was relevant and pertinent to other fields of interest, and how it therefore could speak to the world in a different kind of way, could be a resource for the world in a different kind of way. And what we found was that there were so many disciplines that really allowed us to explore things and open the conversation. And, you know, the most notably was mind body medicine and what that meant. And we had a program, and it was small, but the real potential of that area of inquiry and interest seemed so important and was meeting such an important need. I'm for whatever reason thinking of that wonderful Frederick Buechner quote that about vocation, where your deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger, I think it is, or deepest need. And it was almost that was what it was, that the deepest values of what it meant to see the world through the lens of the humanistic tradition was finding its way into these other areas. And one was certainly in terms of mind-body medicine, how important that was to bring the Saybrook perspective to that. But there were other areas that were going on in terms of organizational development. And again, these were happening within the institution, but we conceived of it on a much larger scale and kind of took an Oxford model of thinking about, well, how about if we built these colleges, we built these units that had a kind of autonomy unto themselves. So there would be a college of humanistic psychology, there would be a college of organizational development, there would be a college of mind-body medicine, and then, which, you know, we can talk about in a little bit if you want, a college of design in a way, where the creative element of the human life and the creative process was itself a way into these deep values and principles of the tradition, and so forth. So it became that paper, I believe, became a way to conceive of this university that had these various different fields of inquiry, but were united by some key fundamental beliefs in what human thriving might be about and how to nourish our students to develop their own skills and their own values and their own knowledge base to be able to go out and make a difference in the world. And so Saybrook University was born from that idea. And it was a complete product of this beautiful conversation that the entire community had addressing that question.
Well, and when you were having that conversation in the community, what did that look like? I think for those who are leaders out there listening to this, this is an instructive point about how you brought the community together in dialogue, and would love to hear your reflections on that experience. Yeah.
We literally brought them together. I mean, we had big meetings where we brought people together, sort of like the RCs. RCs, that's what you call
them.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it was sort of like that. It was like, you know, let's bring this community together and let's have them wrestle with the question. And then let's take a good year to develop a plan to understand, A, sort of who we are and what it is we want to do, but what might this look like and how could we take the first steps to doing it? And form task force committees to address certain parts of the plan and then bring everybody together again to move it forward. And so collectively, an idea was created. It's a process that, again, harkens back to my theater days. There was an idea. And why I say directing is such an important model for me for college presidential leadership is that there was an idea, but then you have your cast and your crew and your design team, and you need to coordinate. The work is to hand over. The work is to empower. The work is to draw from them, but ultimately to create ownership among that community. Because that most important moment in the theater is between a spectator and a performer. And the director is nowhere in sight. That's not the point, right?
Right.
And similarly, in what we do, that most important moment of learning between a student and a teacher, a student and a student, or you've created a community that owns that moment, that enables it, and the college president should be nowhere. You know, that's not the point. It's something that has been enabled and empowered. And that's what happened, that it wasn't Lauren Buckman's creation. It was Lauren Buckman trying to ask the question and trying to orchestrate and direct this show. So ultimately, the people who are important understood it, owned it, created it, made it, shaped it, brought it to life.
Such a great way to put it, Lauren. I love that. You're going to get another whack at this at the end of the interview today, but I'm going to ask you for our audience. You've talked a lot about the humanistic ethos, the psychology, the philosophy behind the work we do here at Saybrook. For those out there who have no idea, like why this would matter, what is humanistic psychology in particular, and how did this inform the threading that you looked at, whether it was design or education or organizational systems, et cetera?
Look, you know, I say this with a lot of caution because there are colleagues and friends at Saybrook who have spent their life thinking about this.
Oh, for sure.
They're the ones who taught me. But I'll tell you ultimately what I think about, and that is, It's a view of human experience from a position of strength, not weakness, not a sense of the problems or scarcity, but the abundance of human possibility. It's about potential over deficit. So, I mean, I remember conversations very clearly about what it means to approach the psychological model and the therapeutic model, particularly from a point of deficit versus asking the question from a different place about possibility and thriving. And by that changing of our attitude or our direct, our attention a certain way, something else is opened up and discovered, and a possibility exists that can be very rich and beautiful, as opposed to beginning with a deficit and bringing it to a certain point of being. Look, the story that is most meaningful to me, frankly, in all of this, comes from my experience with a project I was involved in before I got to Saybrook, called the Ed Roberts Campus. And those of you who know Ed Roberts, he was really one of the founders of the independent living movement. Serious Disabilities in the 60s was the first to go to UC Berkeley, was rejected by Berkeley in the 60s on the basis of being unemployable. I mean, this guy was severely disabled, an iron lung machine in the whole bit. And Ed Roberts, he fought that and ultimately was victorious and began what was a really important early stages of the independent living movement. The image that I have of Ed Roberts, or the insight, or the gift that he brought to the world, was the following: don't give us your pity. Give us the opportunity to live independent lives. And the great image and the great example of that is the curb cut, which is Ed's invention, so that I can take my chair.
That's right. Yeah.
And I can move independently, and I can have the dignity and the strength and the richness of a life that allows me to live independently. And it seems to me that for me always summed up to me the kernel, the jewel that was the humanistic tradition. Don't start with me as a cripple, he would say. Start with me as a human being, and then let's find the ways that will allow me to thrive and bring out my own strength and my own sense of power.
That's incredible. That was beautifully encapsulated. Thank you for that.
Well, Ed Roberts was an amazing, amazing man. And there is in Berkeley, over the Ashby BART station, an entire Ed Roberts campus. That's the project we worked on. And all of the various different organizations on this very point. I mean, it was through Ed Roberts that ultimately the ADA was built.
That's right.
And you might want to see the documentary, if you haven't, Crip Camp, I believe it's called.
I know Jim LaBrecque personally. We've watched it. And
Yeah. I'm also friends with some of those folks too. And amazing, amazing people. And the Ed Roberts campus is itself, I mean, another topic for another time, but it's a miracle in and of itself. I mean, I learned so much from that experience. It was quite wonderful.
Well, thank you for weaving that in. And I think that it just really captures nicely and beautifully and poignantly for our audience what Saybrook's all about. So shifting gears momentarily into more Saybrook stuff, if you will, we're getting into actualizing that bigger vision that you and the faculty at the time laid out, possibly exploring the work in design, creativity. I'd be curious from your perspective, because you can probably see the pattern here. We're going to get into your most recent work at Art Center here in Pasadena. But talk about creativity in the arts, especially in education, where it's at right now, what we as a society should really be thinking about and trying to understand with respect to prioritizing or figuring out how to maintain these important disciplines into the future. It's a loaded question, probably, but
yeah. How much time do you have?
I think we're at 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think the first thing I would say, you know, a lot of this comes from the learning that happened for me in the publication of a recent book that I put out called Make to Know, in which I really try to explore. Well, I try to really upend the notion that artists and designers work from a place of vision first, and then and that their work becomes manifesting that vision. Michelangelo, who sees the angel in the stone, and then chips away until it's set free, kind of thing. And that's a very common, even among some of the Art Center students, alas, but it's a very common sense of what it is. You see it in your mind's eye, and then you manifest vision. And I think for a lot of reasons, thinking about the creative life or even life itself, frankly, as manifesting vision is a very limited perspective. And instead, what artists and designers talk about, and what I learned so powerfully in my time at Art Center, was that there is a very special kind of revelation that comes through making, broadly speaking. The process of writing, the process of putting together a painting, what it means to engage materials, what it means to work and to make in whatever field you might be involved in, what it means to compose music and what role improvisation plays, what it means to perform and to act. I mean, you look at each discipline and you can see that it's the making itself that becomes the vehicle through which these artists and designers discover what it is they want to create and, interestingly and pertinent for Saybrook, who they are. I mean, one of the most wonderful ways of expressing this is from Joan Didion, who said, "I'd have no reason to write if I could access my thoughts in any other way." And so that her own making as a writer becomes a way of knowing herself. And this becomes a really important part of the book and how people think about that. But I think for the question that you're asking, what's so important here is the human capacity to make is probably something that's not, that we don't pay enough attention to. It is one of our great gifts that we can make things, and through the making of things, and I'm deliberately being vague because I think it applies to everything. I think it applies to who we are in relationship with one another. I think it applies to the way in which we engage with community. I think it applies to who we are as leaders. I think it applies to who we are as educators. That there is a need to go really from a place of uncertainty and not knowing to engage, and then through that process to discover, and then it keeps on moving forward. So uncertainty becomes this necessary place. We have questions, we have notions, we have ideas. Some artists talk about they have stomach aches, something that compels us forward to move into a space of uncertainty. And we often think about uncertainty as a frightening and destabilizing place, and it is, but it's also a deeply creative place. And if we can move into that place, and we're willing to move in and to begin to create and begin to make, and then we can find within that all kinds of wonders and treasures that would have never been available to us otherwise. And certainly for somebody like myself, I could have never imagined that, envisioned what would be. But I am somebody who has gone into these places of uncertainty as a theater director, as a teacher, as a college president, and begun just the way I described the process at Saybrook. We made that vision. We didn't know going in. We knew we had this question, and that was the portal. That was the entry point for us. And we collectively made it and came out with something that no one of us could have ever come up independently, or certainly not envisioned. And our work didn't become the manifestation of vision so much as it became a making to know where we needed to head. And this, of course, doesn't stop. It continues on perpetually, really, of a continuous making.
Right.
That's why I think that the notion of the creative piece was so important to this, ultimately to what Saybrook is about and what the humanistic tradition is all about. Because one of those great places of potential, one of those great strengths, one of those places of abundance is our capacity as makers. And how do we think about that, and how do we engage in it? One other point I'll make before I pause. This cannot be mistaken as we make it up as we go along. And here's, again, the importance of education, that we go into these places of uncertainty, but we bring our experience and our education and our talents and our skill base and our ethics. But that's, for me, the scaffolding we stand on as we reach into a place of uncertainty. And there's this wonderful kind of discovery that was so clear to me coming into the Art Center world, where it was almost as if the greater the skill, the greater the freedom. And so what we needed to do, to the rigor we needed to apply, the understanding, the practice, the 10,000 hours, whatever you want to call it, it's not something that limits and tightens and on the contrary, in the creative life, in the making life, it opens up possibility. And again, you hear the echoes of the Saybrook world and of the humanistic tradition. And so the education becomes about helping our students build that scaffolding, because really, the more they do and the more experience they have and the more education, the more thoughtful they are, so many things, really, the further they can reach into places of uncertainty, and maybe most importantly, they can have the courage to go into these places of uncertainty in the first place.
You need those skills.
Yeah, the education becomes about really finding the courage, teaching courage.
That's really well stated. And I appreciate that as someone who's a former, I think we're always what we are, I guess, as a former classical musician, though, that framework that was built in tandem with my instructors, with my conducting coaches and whatnot, was essential for me in the creative process to really blossom, right? And yet, you know, you'd think sometimes that those boundaried areas where you go, is that constraining? It actually gave me more freedom to create and manifest certain things that I didn't think were possible at the time. I really appreciate you pointing that out as well.
That's so interesting, Nathan, because very clearly designers say that all the time. And I'll go to your world in a minute, but designers teach us that constraints are not what limit them. Constraints are what open possibility. Really clearly they say that, right? And then, of course, in the music world, in the performing world, which you and I are both in, right, you can't improvise out of nowhere. Improvisation, right? Improvisation is a great example of the kind of make to know, because in a way, the process of creating it and the thing being created are one and the same. It's like make to know is perfectly aligned in a certain kind of way as that's unfolding, right? But improvisation, as you know, can't happen out of, just as you explained, it's not in a void. There's a context, right? And there's a frame. And then within that, something can happen. And imagine, as I tried to do, imagine thinking about education that way.
That's right. That's right.
What do we do very well intentioned when we build our curricula? We build requirements. And at some point, requirements are necessary to it, but at some point, requirements become the most uncreative way to build an education.
Absolutely.
So think about your experience in music. Think about building frames instead of requirements, which allow our students to maybe find their way, let the breeze blow through the experience a little bit, not tighten it down. Again, it comes from a very good place. We want them to know this, and we want them to know this, and we want to have this experience, and we want them to know that. We only have them for a limited amount of time. And there's something, I think, that opens it up if you think about those frames. You think about how those constraints can be less a tightening and more of a place to hold the learning, a safety place, you know. A context.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I the example that was that I've used before, and I think it applies here as well, kind of to accentuate the point you're making. When I was grousing in undergrad about, we had to go through these scale exams where, you know, our faculty would sit there in this group, and in addition to the performance jury, and I'd complain mightily about this. Just seems so, you know, ridiculous, draconian, give me a break, you know, why do we need this? And my trombone professor early on, he sat me down, he's like, listen to this recording for a minute. And it was this amazing musician playing at Monterey Jazz Festival, didn't know who, but he was doing some amazing stuff within those boundaries. He said, this is John Coltrane, this guy knows his stuff.
Exactly.
But
right.
He pointed out that he was bounded within, and then he exploded those boundaries in ways that the human mind could not have imagined at the time, and created a whole new vista of creativity, music, you know, art that we did not imagine. And all the points you just raised, I think they're interconnected in those ways that, not to get too stuck on the boundary piece, but I think that's such a beautiful way of putting it. And I love how you really emphasize the requirements in education. We do so much to, at times in education, to demotivate And rather than to figure out how do we create within, right? How do we, yes, you need these skills, but then how do you create and manifest different ways of being and knowing, ways you never thought possible?
It's a perfect, and your story of Coltrane is perfect. It's a perfect illustration of what I mean. The example I often use is Keith Jarrett, who for exactly the same, and I make the same point, and what that whole story of the concert at Cologne was all about, with that broken piano and the rain and that amazing story, right? And he created what is probably the greatest improvised live concert of all time. It's because he had, because he knew his scales, to put it in the terms you were just using, right? I mean, the greater the skill, the greater the freedom. I mean, there really is this wonderful kind of relationship there.
You know, we're coming to our conclusion today, and it saddens me because you and I could share probably hours talking about a range of things. Talk a little bit about your time at Art Center. You've retired after an amazing tenure there, and I was bragging about you to our audience in the introduction and the work you've done. And I know you are the kind of human being that says, well, it wasn't just me, it was this collective of individuals, but you've left a mark there. Maybe talk about for just a couple minutes your work there and your legacy, or the legacy of Art Center, where it's going, what you hope for.
It was a 13-year journey, one that really was incredibly exciting for me. Interestingly, I learned something very important in the last couple of years, because I wasn't able to, during the pandemic, obviously, I wasn't able to kind of walk the halls and see students working on their projects and talking to them and hearing their issues and their struggles of the moment or their excitement about an idea that had just come. And that was so energizing for me always. And I think leading remotely during the course of the pandemic, I realized how much I missed that, and how, you know, without it, without sort of getting to the core of what the place was all about, I had to try to, I suppose, invent it in other ways. It was still a fantastic place to be, but it felt I was missing that piece of it, that kind of essence of it. And my interaction with the students, which always gave me so much strength, really became a little more transactional. And so I had to invent ways to keep alive with the students and the faculty. So that was an interesting lesson. So much of what we've talked about today came through in my work there. You know, I tell this story about design that I think has incredible, it's a beautiful metaphor that I think has incredible ramifications for really what my time at Art Center was all about. And I came to, in a way, similar to Saybrook, but when I got to Art Center, it was a struggling place in a way. Not so much in the way Saybrook was, but it was a difficult transition in presidential leadership. It was wounded. Let me just say that it was a wounded community, and it needed healing. And I'm quite convinced that part of my calling, part of the reason I went there, was to help with that healing process. And I was able to really employ a lot of the things we've talked about today, which was, you know, handing over and giving strength to and creating a place where a community went into a space of uncertainty and really began to make itself again. And a lot of that happened in really interesting ways. But the way I like to sum it up is this story of, it's about 20 years ago, there was an intersection in a small town in Holland that was incredibly dangerous. Cars smashing into each other and pedestrians being hit and bicyclists being knocked off their bikes. And it was just a nightmare. And the response of the traffic officials was to create more and more authoritative restrictions, more signs, slow down here, don't go there, avoid this. What? Anyway, the more they did that, the worse things got. There was a traffic designer by the name of Hans Moreman. He was fascinated by, not so much by adding restriction and authoritative voice, but more kind of removing restriction, opening things up. And he was fascinated by observing people in a crowded skating rink, for example, where there was a natural tendency for human beings to kind of avoid smashing into each other. I mean, there's always some robust character who's, you know, but basically it was just, you know, it was people do get, and then you think about in nature, if you think about a flock of birds and how they can move in this kind of precise choreography, or a school of fish or whatever. And what he did sort of on the basis of that notion is he removed all restrictions in science and he redesigned the entire intersection to be a roundabout. And the moment he did so, the accident stopped, the cars were not smashing into each other, the pedestrians were safe, the bicyclists were able to go through safely and freely, and the problem was addressed. And you begin to think about why that was so interesting. First of all, you remove the superego, you remove that kind of authoritative voice and open up. But it goes to exactly what we were talking about earlier. It allowed participants of that intersection to be the makers of their own safety. And the reports are, as I'm approaching that roundabout, I naturally slow down and look for what's around me because it has a bit of ambiguity. I don't know. I'm going into a place of uncertainty. I'm not sure about it. And so I naturally slow down and I'm more observant and participating in making that a safe environment for people of my community, really. And so it's a powerful metaphor, but it's also the lesson for me at Art Center that really what I did was I helped build a roundabout. I helped a community participate in its own development, its own making, and its own creative life as an educational institution, as a creative institution. When I look at that, to sort of learn about that and reading that, and it's one of those moments where you sort of look at something and go, that's absolutely right, that's it. And that can have ramifications for so much. Can we build roundabouts for our institutions? Can we build roundabouts for the education of our students? Can we help encourage this wonderful virtue we have, this gift we have as human beings, to be makers and creators of our own thriving communities?
We're going to leave it there, I think, on that point. It was incredibly well stated. I could listen to you all day, every day. Inspiring. I appreciate that. We leave the audience officially with two quick takes from each guest. So these are quick things that come to mind for you. So the first question, what does the term humanistic mean to you?
Human thriving.
Human thriving. All right. Very good. And the last question for our audience today, when you think about all the challenges, the dysfunctions that are in the world, we like to provide our listeners with hope. What are three things that an individual can do right now in this moment to help make their world, the world, a better place?
Build roundabouts, one. Build curb cuts, two. And just always ask the question as a way of getting you into these places of uncertainty, but always lead with the question of how can we live the most meaningful lives?
Dr. Lauren Buckman, president, former president of Art Center of Saybrook University, fabulous human being, friend, thank you so much for being here today on Saybrook Insight.
Thank you, Nathan. It's a delight. Thank you very much.
As with every conversation I've had with Dr. Buckman, I leave today with a lot of gratitude and super inspired. I hope you enjoyed Lauren as much as I did. Remember his three major takeaways, and I love these. Build roundabouts, build curb cuts, and always ask the question about how can we live with the most impact. If you want to see the video elements from today, we've created these, and you can see those on our Saybrook YouTube page. If you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave that 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, and others. Remember to check our show notes today for information on Dr. Buckman, including links to websites, his book, Make to Know, and much more. And for more about our university, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on any of the areas of study that interests you at the very top of the page and locate that program to learn more, or simply Google Saybrook University. As always, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for joining us. Take care and be well.